coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the official Curious Realm coverage of the 2024 Falk Monster Festival here in Falk, Arkansas. We are joined by our good friend and guest, Chester Moore. How you doing, Chris?
Great to have him. Great to be on your show again, man.
It's always
a lot of fun.
Always love whenever we get to hang out. You are a heck of a guy and an amazing researcher. You probably spend more time in the field than any other researcher I know because of your work with wildlife reporting.
A lot of different parts of wildlife research, you know?
And your new book, Bigfoot South, let's get into that real quick. What brought you to write that?
Well, you know, I originally wrote this book 20 years ago, released it 20 years ago, and I was holding my own conferences back then called the Southern Crypto Conference.
Okay.
And I needed to have some merch to sell there, and I'm like, you know, I haven't seen anything that's been on this phenomenon really Southern focused, you know, so I decided to start putting together accounts and things that I heard, and it came a pretty big project. We released it, and I stopped doing my conferences, and this is the 20-year mark. And there's so many people asking about it that I decided what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back and take the original text. I'm going to add about 3 new chapters. I'm going to put a whole bunch of more research from the last 20 years that's in there and put together some really cool stuff. And I'm really excited about this, really a re-release of a book that, you know, that's got a lot of demand, but very few people have been able to check it out. So I'm pretty excited about it.
Well, and it goes into all kinds of things from oil prints on windshields. But my favorite is whenever books have color photographs.
I have to put color stuff in there.
Black and white is great, but especially once you start talking wildlife and variations.
Yeah, and that's, you mentioned like the variations and stuff. Like to me, that's an important thing to be able to show those delineations and stuff in photos. Only color is going to nail that, you know?
Yeah.
And I talk about like what I'm talking about here at the conference, feral apes and monkeys. Is part of this phenomenon. And I have a whole chapter on that, you know, and to me that's, we don't know. There are no Bigfoot experts.
Yes.
You know, I'm a journalist pursuing this, and I will openly admit I believe these creatures are real. I believe they're a biological entity, but no one really knows. So there's a lot of things associated with the phenomenon, vocalizations, tracks, other things, signs like people call them nesting areas and stuff like this.
Yeah.
Well, we have verified feral monkey populations in multiple locations in the South. I have gathered numerous reports of people call them baboons in the South. And then there's this really intriguing possibility of feral apes. So, you know, it's kind of an all-inclusive, here's all the weird stuff related to Bigfoot in the South.
Yeah, and granted, you know, there are research facilities, especially all over the South, when it comes to primates. There's one right up the road in Bastrop, right down the road from me in Austin. And to think that, you know, monkeys don't escape, that animals don't, like animals escape zoos regularly.
And the thing is, in Texas, down by Dilley, there is an established Japanese macaque population.
Oh, wow.
And the first time, and I'll share the story with you, but in my opening part of my presentation is that 25 years ago, I was doing an article, I was bow hunting in South Texas, doing an article about hunting hogs down there. And a guy told me a buddy of his was in this little ground blind in this creek bottom before daylight down there and heard this terrible scream, scared the crap out of him. A few minutes later, a little hairy hand reaches into the stand. He jumps out the blind and looks over with the flashlight, and there's this big monkey. And that was my first introduction to the feral monkey thing. And now in my book and presentation, I have photos that are of these monkeys just sitting on a fence post by a deer blind or something like that. So, and so it was interesting because the guy said his first thought when he heard the scream, maybe that's some kind of Bigfoot or something, but it was a monkey. So there's a lot of stuff like that. That's part of the phenomenon that's different out there. So to me, I'm a journalist. I'm going to go where the story leads me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not always to, you know, critter like that, maybe. It's something else related to it. We see these things out there. So I take some little rabbit trails here and there, and it's all part of the phenomenon. Yeah.
Well, and let's explore some of your presentation real quick, especially the idea of feral monkey populations, feral ape populations. What would it take for a population to succeed? What would it take for there to become a population, just a single breeding pair? Or?
You'd have to have at least that to start off with.
Yeah.
But I think it would probably have to be more than that to be more realistic. But if you're looking at like apes, and there were numerous facilities in Florida, so there's there is a rhesus monkey population in one area of Florida that are a direct result of an escape by a place called the Chimp Farm. It was a local name for it. And to get like orangutans and chimpanzees and like lowland gorillas especially, you're pretty much going to have to be a major zoo these days.
Yeah.
Well, this was a small backwoods place that had lowland gorillas, orangutans, and chimps. And we know this population of rhesus established started from there. I guarantee you, if rhesus monkeys escaped, there's a very good chance some apes escaped at some point.
Yeah.
Well, primates are very long-lived.
Mm.
You know, you could have had a 5-year-old lowland gorilla pair get out.
Yeah.
And in the 60s, they could still be alive.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and they have the habitat that would match it in parts of the Everglades. So there's a very interesting, you know, the Bigfoot phenomenon in Florida is related to the term skunk ape.
Mm.
And you have this very famous photo that Lauren Coleman first uncovered called the Mayaca ape.
Yeah.
And it looked, the lady sent it to the police thinking it was an orangutan.
Yep.
And it looks like an orangutan.
Yeah.
So it's all in that area. And so I thought that was important to look at, you know, because what happens is I have always relied on my audience, readers, listeners, viewers, since I started to solicit information. So I kind of consider my journalism collective journalism with everyone else.
Yeah.
So you put a word out and you go, hey, that guy doesn't think I'm crazy. Maybe I'll send him this picture or I'll tell him my story. So when I do things like this, I guarantee a story is going to come in today.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps create a broader understanding of what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. Sightings happen regularly. Even last night, whenever we were at dinner and stuff like that, you know, Craig announced like, no, there was a falk sighting monster as soon as the day before.
Which is wild.
Two days ago, there was a sighting.
Which
of
is
the
wild.
Monster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's just it. These things happen fairly regularly. When you go to, you know, North American Wood Ape Conservancy, NAWAC, when you go to BFRO, stuff like that, these databases are updated regularly, and they happen pretty frequently.
Yeah, and what's cool about this is everything sort of gets put under a Bigfoot umbrella.
Yeah.
And but if you look like Lauren Coleman, I reference him again. I'm always about giving credit where credit's due.
I love his work.
And he has the feel. Him and Patrick Wahey, I think, did the field guide to Bigfoot's mysterious primates or whatever it's called. Yeah. Other kind of mysterious cryptid primates around the world, and a lot of them are very monkey and ape looking. There's a devil monkey listed in there. So there are other parts of this mystery that I think once, if there's ever disclosure of the Sasquatch phenomenon, I think that we're going to have a lot of better scientific interest in it and maybe some other understanding of what's going on. I guarantee that unless it was a, like, you couldn't deny video caught on a trail camera of an orangutan come through the swamp, science is afraid to touch that.
Yeah.
Because it might be linked to the skunk ape.
It might be.
So they ignore it. It's not like there's an official designation among agencies, don't touch it. It's just the understanding. If you want your grant to research, let's
leave that one be.
So I think there's a lot of that out there, too. And and really, even in my industry as a wildlife journalist, and most people don't, I might be the only mainstream guy touching this stuff.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. There might be a few others. I mean, you got to consider YouTubers mainstream now, but,
well, and you know, you really do have to get the one thing that I love of the work of King Gerhardt is that he always emphasizes the zoo.
Yeah. He does that as well.
Zoology.
Yeah.
And the idea of we have to look at these things and because I mean, we discover tens of thousands of species a year.
I was speaking of like the fishing, hunting, wildlife part of the world for me, but Ken is always into like the zoological part.
Absolutely.
Of it. He's kind of a throwback to like, you know, like some guys, like I think it was Ivan Sanderson who was big into, you know, so a lot of those early guys kind of went into it from that perspective.
That's right.
And he works with the San Antonio Zoo.
Well, absolutely.
And that's important.
Yeah.
That is Scott Marlowe with the Pangea Institute, who passed away a few years ago. Mm. He was very much into that as well.
Yeah.
So that's a cool part, and we're soliciting strange reports of photos and videos of weird things that are happening out there.
Well, and we had you on a pre-record not too long ago talking about your work with the Great White Conservancy and with GulfGreatWhites.com, all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that you mentioned was that great whites don't even hit a breeding cycle till they're 30 years old. And that's something that I think that a lot of people don't realize, especially when you're talking primates, things like that. Like when you're talking chimpanzees, it's almost the same thing. They're like 15 years old.
Yeah, I don't know the exact, but it's not like they not like a white-tailed deer where they throw twins every year.
Yeah.
When they're a year and a half old.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's
exactly.
And so slow reproductive rates and long-lived animals.
Yeah.
So I think there could be I know for a fact that the primate thing is integrated into the Sasquatch phenomenon, at least from the vocalization perspective.
Sure. You
know, for sure.
Sure.
Because that's a big part of people. I've heard this and I heard that.
Yeah.
But I think we're about to learn a lot more about it. I just really think that it's coming to a head.
Well, we are, especially when it comes to the forensic data, when it comes to DNA analysis, things like that, the fact that we are now able to lift DNA from oil alleles, like on the handprints.
That's amazing stuff.
That are shown. Yeah, things like that. Yeah. Like, we're going to start seeing a whole new realm of data come in on this. So especially once you start applying and getting AI to start sorting things out.
Yeah, and that's a great thing about, like you mentioned, like AI and the tech part of this. Because what it's going to come into is that the average person is going to have access to a lot of this. Mm. And then that will force science to look at stuff.
There's actively a new AI, and I'm trying to remember where I read it. I think it may have been Nature. Where there is a new AI where you can literally put in wildlife calls.
Yeah.
And it will search the database of known wildlife calls and tell you what that animal is.
See, that's going to be next level. And my good friend, Dr. Natalie
Game
Schmidt,
changer.
You know, she created some DNA collection technology that can be tested in the field.
Awesome.
Instead of some guy spending time in, you know, some obscure mountain range in Asia looking for an endangered subspecies of leopard.
Yep.
And coming back and realizing the scat he collected wasn't a leopard, it was some other cat.
Well, you know? And even still then, you're carrying on an expedition in the field for a week and a half. How are you maintaining those samples? How are you not deprecating those samples with humidity, everything else? How are you assuring the fact that those samples are right to get to a lab?
No, it's
for
the
proper analysis.
It's a great point you bring up, Chris, about this technology and the AI going to be a great aid to what's going on out there.
Yeah.
And it's also going to be a great aid to people who want to phony stuff too, you know,
level.
Well, but that's, to me, the important part of that is looking at how we can use that as a positive. And, and what happens is, I mean, I probably in the fishing, hunting, wildlife part of this, I know I put the most stuff out about like stuff that's not supposed to be there, whether it's the cats and stuff we talked about before. And there's like a whole other side of American wildlife that's like introduced species and things aren't supposed to be there.
Yeah,
And it's like there's like an underground of wildlife.
It's kind of like a axis deer here in Texas. Like you see it, feel free to shoot in in season or out. You need no tag.
Feral hogs, awdad.
You know.
So there's a whole list and a whole litany of stuff out there. So I'm excited about exploring more of the feral primate side of this stuff. So,
it's a part that I think really needs to be explored because that is where we start the sorting process.
Yep.
You know, that's where you start the culling and even it. You mentioned a minute ago, everything's been thrown into a Bigfoot bin. That's something that we talk about on the show regularly that discourages science from wanting to get involved. Like, I am one of the people who is a big believer in, I'm glad that they relabeled UFO to UAP, because now you have included the concept of phenomenon, which is exactly the realm of science.
Sure.
Like, if you have an aberration in your experiment, you have to explore what the aberration is.
Yep.
That's science, because you have to be able to segregate.
I mean,
it
might not be Gort, but it's, which I love Gort here. I've always loved your Gort you have. I'm a big Lady Earth Stood Still, original one fan.
Yeah.
But it's something.
Yeah.
Right? And it might not be the Patterson-Gimlin creature, but it's something.
That's right.
You know, so,
that's right.
Yeah.
So, wrapping things up, man, what is next on your plate? What are you looking for? What can people do to get involved with conservancy out there?
Well, I always say find a wildlife species that you're passionate about and find an organization that is involved in its conservation. So if you're into great white sharks, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, OSearch. If you're into southern bottomland habitat, the National Wild Turkey Federation is a great group because they do a lot of habitat work. So find something you can, you know, become a member of, you know, you have a voice for that habitat. And then, you know, otherwise, if you have a kid that may be facing some kind of special challenge in what they do, and maybe they've had an illness or an abuse issue or something, or even going through a really hard depression, they might like wildlife, or they might like Sasquatch. Reach out to me. We have a program called Wild Wishes. We would love to connect them with something like that. And you can email me at chester@chestermore.com or get more information at higher calling.net.
Absolutely, yeah, Chester. Man. Thank you.
God bless you, buddy. Thank Always you. Good. Yeah,
absolutely, man. Same. Your work is absolutely amazing. Your research is phenomenal. While you are online, checking out everything from Chester Moore, Higher Calling Wildlife, and Gulf Coast Great Whites, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can find all the episodes. It's where you can like, follow, subscribe, share, comment. You can find all these episodes on YouTube. We will be back right after these quick breaks, everybody, with more guests right here at the Falk Monster Festival 2024 in Falk, Arkansas. Be right back after this. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Curious Realm's continuing coverage of the Falk Monster Festival live here in Falk, Arkansas. We are joined by Brandy Butcher, one of the hosts of Blondes and Booze. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I have seen you at numerous conferences around. Yes. Tell us a little bit about Blondes and Booze and how you got involved with it.
Well, Blondes and Booze was around before I got involved in it, and it was two friends, and they would just talk about paranormal activity and things like that. And as time went on, they invited me to come on the show, and there was three of us. Well, one of the ladies had to back out, so then there were two of us. But then the two of us that were left decided, hey, we not only like the paranormal, we like the cryptid side, the alien side, or anything with high strangeness.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, my show is very much in the same vein. It's interesting to meet other people that cover things in different ways. And you guys have a lot of storytelling on your show. You have a lot of people that come on and share experiences. What are some of the more interesting Bigfoot experiences that y'all have had shared?
Well, you know, mine is I guess my most exciting, I guess, because it happened to me.
Sure. Tell us about it.
Well, we were in the Ozarks. We were in Missouri, and we were attending a conference, but it was also a camp out. Mm. And we'd already been there for a couple of days, and we decided, hey, we were going to go out and do a little bit of hiking at night. Well, this big storm came in. Well, it tore up the whole camp, and there was things everywhere. Trash was everywhere. We thought, you know what? We can't fix anything. We're going to wait till morning. So this is about 2:30 in the morning. We decided, hey, we're gonna just go to bed, and we'll pick it all up in the morning.
Yeah.
So we had all went to bed. Well, I had picked up my bed out of my tent because I didn't want it wet. So I threw it in my vehicle, and I said, I'm just going to sleep in my vehicle. I am not pulling all this back out. I don't want it all wet. So I had went to sleep in the driver's side of my car, and I was watching the tent, and then I just went to sleep, and I'm like, okay. So then I started hearing a tapping on my car. I didn't open my eyes or anything. I just heard a tapping on the front of my car. I figured, oh, it was raindrops or something else, and I'm like, okay, that's fine. Mm. And then, you know, I start hearing this walk-in around the car. So I'm thinking it's one of the ladies I was with, and we, you know, we have this code. Ladies don't go out in the wilderness and use the restroom at night by themselves. Somebody's always got to be on watch. So I got up and I looked at the tent. I didn't see a light. I didn't see that the tent was unzipped or anything. Mm. So I started scanning across the front of my car. When I got to the other side of my car, out the passenger side, I saw something standing there. At first, I had literally thought it was somebody standing there, like a human standing there.
Sure.
And I'm thinking, that's awfully big. So my next thought was, okay, we're in bear country. That's possible. But it was standing up. I'm like, okay, that's okay too. But it wasn't that. When I got a really good look at it, because the moonlight was kind of showing on the back of it, it was like about 6.5 foot tall. And I mean, the chest was like super wide. And I'm thinking, that's not a bear and that's not a human. And when it kicked in, what I was really looking at, I'm thinking, that's Bigfoot. So all of a sudden my adrenaline started kicking up. I'm sitting there and I'm like, I can't grab my phone because as soon as I grab my phone, that light's going to come on. It's going to see me.
Mm.
And I'm like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at it and I'm like, I can't do anything else. I'm kind of stuck here. So I'm just like, well, I can't do anything else but try to lay back down exactly how I was and hope that it didn't see me.
Yeah.
Or it wasn't watching me.
Yeah.
When I was looking at it, though, it was kind of swaying back and forth, you know, kind of trying to, it looked like to me, trying to decide what it was going to do, if it was going to go further in. Mm. I think because with all the trash that was thrown about and things like that, it was looking for a free meal, you
sure,
know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
But it had been, I think it had been watching us for a couple of days, and it was just the perfect time. Everybody went to bed.
Interesting.
And they thought, well, you know, let's just go look.
And, you know, that the more researchers that I talk to, the more people that I talk to, that is a commonality that I hear. They weren't out in the woods for that purpose. They weren't out in the woods hunting that. They were just out in the woods, or they were just camping. And
Exactly. Because
they were quiet, because they were still, because they weren't raising a ruckus or using the one I've always wondered is infrared trail cams. Because, well, a critter like that would see in the night, which means it would see in the partial infrared, which means that would be like a spotlight to them.
Well, see,
you
I
wonder why they're
caught,
avoiding
yeah.
a trail cam?
Right, because I've never caught anything on an infrared. Nothing
well,
at all.
And that's just it. You know, it's right. Like there are some things there that I can understand the want to use them, but yeah, like any animal that's roaming around at night sees into the near infrared, they would see that the same way as an LED flashlight.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So those things tend to kind of scare it away as opposed to just being there, and especially being there in the same spot for numerous days.
Right, right. Well, what made this, I guess, an awesome thing is because we had actual seasoned trackers there.
Oh, wow.
And they actually tracked where this thing came out of the woods in the tree line, went back in the tree line, and then walked down and came back around the back of the tent that was supposed to be in.
Wow.
And then there were other people hearing it walk. So all of our timelines, they didn't come out of their tent, but all of the timelines matched up. Not only that, Daniel Perez from the Bigfoot Times out of California, mm-hmm. he was there.
Oh, wow.
So he got to interview me firsthand. So I ended up, the whole thing was about our encounter because he was there. He was so excited.
Did anyone else in the group and in the party that you were with have an experience, hear anything, see anything other than
I'm the only one that saw it because I had a view.
Yeah.
Everyone else is in their tent, but everybody's timeline matched up. As it was walking around, everybody was talking about, you know, they looked at their clock or they looked at, you know, whatever they had. And you could tell that the timeline matched up with the footsteps and what they were hearing and when it went by. Because they're just all, it was just perfect. It was perfect textbook.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
And one of the things we talk about regularly on the show, especially with people like Chester Moore, who are involved in the world of conservancy,
right,
is the idea of the future. The idea of, yes, like Ryan Edwards was saying earlier, these things are on a long discovery platform. And, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that we heard about lowland gorillas but didn't discover them till 100 years after we heard about them.
Right.
We're verging on the 70-year mark of Sasquatch here in America, at least the modern sightings, things like that, from the point of Patterson-Gimlin to now. Not necessarily Native American lore, Native American stories, but in the modern world. And the idea of conservation, the idea of, you know, we have numerous really close calls with wildlife regularly. Like there were just like coyotes spotted in LA, you know.
Yes.
There's the LA cougar that just died like this last year.
Right.
At a ripe old age. But because we are encroaching on these territories, these animals have become normalized to our presence. You know, like it's pretty common to see videos of somebody with a bear in their backyard digging through trash nowadays,
right.
That kind of stuff. And I regularly bring up, like you said, he was maybe looking for an easy meal because y'all had been there for days. It's like, you think you have a problem with the bear in your trash. Imagine when there's a Sasquatch in the apartment dumpster, you know, because you've encroached too close to a roaming.
Well, you know, and I did ask questions about that after the fact, after the encounter. And I was like, well, what about the bear? Are the bear in that area? They're saying the funniest thing, that where we were camping on the, on this, it was a personal property, that bears would skirt around it, but they would never go through it.
Okay.
So that that amazed me. They said they, you know, they have trackers on the bears out there, and and they try to keep track of them, and they skirt the area. They don't go in the area.
Interesting, interesting. And during your time with Blondes and Booze, have you what's one of the, aside from your story, what's the wildest story that you've heard so far?
You know, I've heard several, and it's kind of hard to choose just one.
The topic,
mine is more like the paranormal is kind of meshing in with the cryptid side, and I think that's where I'm kind of focusing at, is how it's intertwined, but I'm trying to figure out how.
Yeah. And that's something that we talk about regularly on the show. I am a big believer, and I will use my exact phrasing so that people exactly get me.
Right.
I am a believer that there is a large hominid species roaming the forests of North America and beyond across the globe.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But I am also a believer that, much like Dogman, much like other occurrences, specifically paranormal occurrences with Sasquatch, Sasquatch coming through a portal, Sasquatch being tied with UFOs, I think that there may be something else out there, be it like we've discussed with Jason McLean before, something along the lines of the people of the Fae, who are basically using a trope in our mind that we would be okay with. Like, we've just bumped into each other now. If you saw me in my true form, you would be scared to the dickens. Mm-hmm. But what would you allow? And it's using that trope in our mind of what, like, oh, well, they would be okay with seeing a Sasquatch.
Right.
I'm a Sasquatch.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And you're like, well, if it's, you know, seeing a fairy.
Yeah.
It would be like, okay, I'm going to show you myself as a fairy.
Yeah.
So you'll get used to me.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we just had Max Hawthorne on not too long ago, and he was talking about he and his daughter who witnessed witnessed a creature that was very akin to a fairy. Mm-hmm. And he saw it differently than his daughter.
Wow.
She saw, like, Tinkerbell. He saw something else. And I was like, that is a prime example of what I'm talking about, where two people viewing the exact same thing have a totally different experience of what they are physically seeing. Not even like, oh, well, I saw gray hair. Well, I saw brown hair. Same critter. Different color hair. No, like, totally different entity.
Right.
Totally different thing. And phenomenologically, that's interesting to me.
Yeah. Well, in the paranormal community, we use a spirit box.
Sure.
And, you know, it spits out words and it's off a radio frequency. But we have the same thing, but it's to do with your hearing.
Sure.
You may be listening to this and somebody might think it says one thing, but you hear a totally complete different thing.
My wife is a Mondegrain sufferer, and the number of times that I have to, like, no, sweetie, what I said was this.
Yes.
Because she'll laugh and she'll be like, I know you didn't just say this, right? And I'm like, absolutely not. That is not what I said at all. I love you so much. But that's just it. Like, and we discuss that phenomenology on the show regularly. The idea of truth is individual. There's a capital T truth out there, but when it comes to experience is individual. Mm-hmm. And even if you talk to my brother, is literally in the other room. We both grew up with the same single mom. We both have individual experiences of that household.
Right.
We both have individual ways that we view the same family experiences, the same Christmases. We view it from different points of view, you know, and that makes a different experience. It makes a unique experience for both of us, even though we grew up in the same place.
Right, right. It's just kind of like we're always wondering things. Is it really connected? why am I hearing other things? And,
yeah.
And how do we know? It's in the paranormal community also. I have to remember that the paranormal has been part of my life since as far as I can remember. And yeah. Even before I could, my mom would tell me stories.
Yep.
And I would hear things, but I had to figure out, am I hearing it with my ears or am yeah. I hearing it in my head?
Yep. Yep. And I talk to a lot of targeted individuals, people who for years have been complaining, like decades have been complaining about Havana syndrome type symptoms.
Right.
Being targeted by technologies. And one of the things that I tell them when I talk to them and try to explain to them, like, let's start backwalking this in your life. You need to become oh so certain and sure of A, who you are, what you stand for, and what your inner dialogue is.
Mm-hmm.
Learn to know you.
You got to know your body.
And learn to know when
yeah.
you go, wait a minute, that's not my thought pattern.
Right.
That's not me. Let's back that up.
Right.
You know?
Yes, exactly.
And it's important. It's important. And even for paranormal investigation, one mm-hmm. of the things that I've mentioned numerous times is how many times, because I've done paranormal investigation, I've worked with a couple of groups, and it wasn't frequent that while you're preparing gear that you're not talking about where you're going,
mm-hmm.
that you're literally not feeding energy into the idea of what you're going to do.
Right.
You know, like, technically, you should be as scientific and as blank slate as possible. Here is my checklist. This is what I'm bringing. Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not think about stories of the place for a week. Like, you should be going into there as blank slate as possible, because
yes.
technically you might be charging that place before you ever step foot into it.
Right.
You might be actively charging it with energy that might surely create the phenomenon that you're looking for.
Right.
Or even color the way that you look at what you gather.
Right. Well, you know, there are times, you know, we talk about not mentioning when we don't introduce ourselves when we go into a haunted location.
Mm.
Me and Krista on Blondes and Booze, we do not do that.
Good.
Only because as we walk in, as we talk to each other, that spirit will already know you.
Yeah.
They will, just listening to you, they'll know you, because you'll be like, well, hey, Brandy, you know, da, da, da.
Yeah.
They'll already know. You
yeah.
don't have to introduce yourself. They'll pick up on you just like you pick up on them,
yeah.
especially if you're sensitive. Mm. So.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think when it comes to all of these, whether it's UFO, UAP, whether it's paranormal and parapsychological investigation, whether it's cryptid investigation,
mm-hmm.
it is important for us to decompartmentalize things and pull things out of the Kleenex box. The idea, like, I am one of those that is a big proponent of the relabeling of UFO to UAP, because once you include phenomena, now science has to look at it, because that's their job.
Yes.
I don't think I would have passed chemistry if I gave my teacher my work and there was a 3% remainder of solution unaccounted for.
Right.
Where's the 3% anomaly?
Mm-hmm.
Did it go to gas? Did it go to sediment? Was it part of an exothermic reaction? What happened to the 3%? That's now your job in the experiment, is to find out what happened to the 3%. So by pulling it out of those Kleenex boxes, by pulling these things out of Bigfoot
mm-hmm.
and turning them into hominid, let's turn it into something that is a field here that somebody like a Jeffrey Meldrum can look at and say, like, let's start looking at forensic evidence. Let's start looking at new forensic processes. Like, the idea that we can now start to pull and lift DNA off of hand oils, that kind of stuff.
I agree.
It's phenomenal to see, and I continually say, I cannot wait until BFRO, NAWAC, MUFON, everybody starts leveraging AI with their databases.
Mm-hmm.
And starts feeding it into there and finding the true commonalities and finding the true threads, you know, where on those maps you could literally start making red dots and literally, like, make a
yeah.
trail.
Well, you know, in the past, certain communities wouldn't list all of it in the
yeah.
reports.
Yeah.
And I think that they're starting to do that, because you can't explain something if you don't have all the facts.
Well, and it's also the fact of very much... granted, there's a lot of people very upset with Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that. However, the one thing that I love about Arrow is at least they have gone through now and said, it is not shameful for you to come forth and make a report. We will not take your wings or your career from you.
Right.
And here is now a unified way. Because until then, pretty much NICAP and MUFON. They had like the unified systems. MUFON, more than anything, has been pretty much an unchanged intake system since 1969.
Right.
Like they have taken the same information. If it doesn't meet this criteria, it's pushed aside.
Right.
All those things. And that's great for the science of it. And, you know, we have to start doing that. We have to start, A, sharing information. We have to start making these things part of a public database and making it available so that other researchers can find it. If you're hiding it, you've hidden the light under a bushel. Nobody's going to see it now.
Right. They might have a fact or two, but they won't know the whole picture.
That's right. That's right.
So we won't be able to understand anything in any instances if we just don't have all the facts.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever you guys go, because y'all go out and do investigations actively, things like that, correct?
Yes, yes. I do, paranormal-wise, I travel around the United States and I hit all of the big locations that everybody says, oh, this is the most haunted location ever. And I'm like, well, I'm from the Missouri. You're going to have to show me because I'm from the show me state. So I do that. Also, but we do investigate quite a bit for Bigfoot and Dogman in the Land Between the Lakes.
Interesting.
Which now I've not seen a Bigfoot or a Dogman there, but I'll tell you, I have seen very crazy things there, from orbs to sounds to you just hear these really weird things and you see weird anomalies just hanging out in the middle of the woods. But you have to remember, the Land Between the Lakes has like 237 cemeteries.
Yeah.
One of them being, of course, underwater, which used to be the old town of Birmingham that they flooded to make the Land Between the Rivers the Land Between the Lakes.
Yeah.
So, that place is crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And the idea that you flooded a whole town, you know, like that.
Yeah.
That's literally, it's the root of horror movies. Like that's where Poltergeist comes from. Like you moved the gravestones, but you didn't move the bodies.
I know.
You know, like you wonder why things start happening.
You wonder why it's so crazy out there. And it's like, it's creepy beautiful. I just don't know how other to describe that place. The very first time I ever drove in there, I was driving in with, of course, my partner in crime, Krista. And both of us at the same time, our eyes started watering and, you know, the nose started running. It's like we were having a hard time breathing.
Wow.
Going in. But as soon as we reached where we were going to be camping, we were fine.
Interesting.
It was very weird. Nobody else suffered that. It's just her and I. She doesn't suffer from allergies. No, I do. No, I could explain it away if it was just me, but she doesn't.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
It's just a strange place, but I love it, and I love it, and I'll keep going back until I find my answers.
And speaking of Land Between the Lakes and Dogman, that is another one of those that is interesting once you start digging into it, and I think very, very much in the paranormal realm and in the idea of almost egregore. I consider it almost in the idea of, was this thing kind of created and projected into the world by us and by experiencers?
We could have manifested it, you know, we
could have.
But I think things have been going on there long before we ever got there.
Yeah. Give us an example.
There is a farm out there, and it is abandoned, but it is one of their landmarks that they do protect. They keep it up. But I went in there, and I'm recording, and I'm doing EVPs and things like that, and I'm getting voices out of there.
Wow.
So I know that there is residual energy still there. I've seen orbs. There was 10 of us around a campfire, and we all started seeing orbs together. They were all different shapes. All different colors.
Wow.
And everybody was seeing something different. And it wasn't in one place. It was all around us.
Wow.
One person even said that it looked like somebody had a flashlight walking up the hill to us, but there was nobody there. That's how bright it was.
Wow.
So it's just, like I said, it's just a creepy, beautiful place.
That is awesome. And, you know, being out in the field, experiencing things like that, it does put you in a different place. It puts you in a different perspective mm-hmm. when you're looking at other people's evidence now, or data, mm-hmm. I should say, not evidence, data. Because I say it on the show regularly.
Yeah, it's data. You're right.
Evidence is what you give your lawyer to exonerate you.
Right,
like,
right.
Evidence will set you free. That like you better, if you're saying it's evidence, like you better be that certain that's
right.
what it is. Aside from that, you have some amazing data there.
That's a wonderful way to put it.
Let's add that piece of datum to the data set and
right.
let's grow it and let's learn
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
You know, that's how we have to look at it because
true.
The more we call things evidence all the time,
mm-hmm.
it's no different than saying it's a UFO, which if you're looking at it in the terms of, yes, it's an object, it's in the sky, it's moving, and I don't know what it is. Bam. UFO?
UFO.
Absolutely.
Yes.
That is a UFO.
Yes.
Yep. You look at it and you go, look at that alien spaceship.
Wait,
well, let's
is
look
it?
At some, let's,
is
let's
it?
Study some more data.
Yeah.
You know, let's look at some more data on it.
Right.
And that's where I come at it from, because we discover things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we discover on average 10,000 species a year. We
mm-hmm.
are far, far from discovering everything.
Mm-hmm.
Typically on my show, this is where I would overlay and show back to back AB the map of sightings from BFRO, the Bigfoot Research Organization, and an overhead shot of the United States from the ISS at night.
Mm-hmm.
And AB them. And hey, look at all those sightings. Hey, look at where all those dark spots are. Hey, look at all those sightings. Look at where all those dark spots
exactly.
are.
Exactly.
Like, there's 3/4 of the United States that is not lit at night because we ain't there.
Right.
And it's real interesting that that's where a lot of the sightings happen. Like, the Pacific Northwest, a good 5 planes a decade go missing up there. Those things have transponders. They never find those people again.
Yeah, it's just a crazy how that works.
It's a rainforest.
Yeah.
It's a rainforest. We
mm-hmm.
haven't explored it all.
Right.
And for some reason, people have this misguided concept that 95% of the ocean is explored.
Oh,
opposite,
gosh, no.
5%.
Oh, gosh, no.
5% is explored.
Right.
You know.
Because, you know, I'm thinking, you know, we're always talking about aliens being, you know, in space. I'm thinking, what if they're under our ocean? What if they're under there?
Yeah.
There is so much that we don't know.
What if they are us from another time, coming back to see, which explains a lot of why they're really concerned about humanity, why they really want a whole lot of questions answered about nuclear weapons and nuclear processes, and please, good God, take care of yourselves, take care of this planet. Like,
right?
It's interesting, and when you start looking at the work of people like Dr. Michael Hunter, who is an anthropologist and has basically extrapolated out, like, let's look at the evolution of humanity and how we came to the jawline and the skull we have from mm-hmm. Cro-Magnon, and the elongation of it, and the enlarging of our eyes, and the enlarging of our brow. And
right.
if you project that forward by a couple thousand years, we come out pretty gray looking.
Yeah, you know, and I always say this about Bigfoot. What if they're our missing link in that whole
yeah.
line? What if
yeah.
they just said, hey, we're done, we're leaving, you know, we're jumping out of this?
Well, and for those of you who are like, well, theory of evolution, not scientific fact of evolution,
mm-hmm.
not scientific law of evolution,
mm-hmm.
theory, which means there was a hypothesis, now there's some data, we're still experimenting, that's why it's a theory. When you go back and look at the bones of Lucy, there that's like a 15% complete skeleton.
Right.
You know? So there's a lot missing
yeah,
in our human story. We just, in the last 2 years, discovered Dragon Man in China.
There's so many things coming out.
A 10-foot tall human with a skull almost twice the volume.
Yeah, it's just you know, I just wonder when that people are actually going to say, hey, this is a fact, this is real.
Yeah,
you know, there are so many people saying, well, there's just not enough evidence. There's not enough evidence. There's that word, evidence.
Data.
But you got to
data.
Look at the data.
The data.
That's
is what
right.
you have to look at.
Yeah.
Because you can say whatever you want about conspiracy theory, folks. If we didn't have conspiracy theorists, nobody would be sitting in jail. That's quite literally the job of a DA, is to take data, give you a narrative, pull you down a line, and sell you on it.
Right.
They are conspiracy theorists by trade. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, nobody would be convicted of conspiracy, and there's a lot of people in jail for it.
I believe it. You know, I believe it. And I'm just like, you know, you have to watch what you say. You're like, am I one of those people? I got to be quiet.
And, you know, but there is so much out there, and people are so ready to make a hard decision when we need to look at more data. We need to bring in more data.
Yeah.
We need to bring in bigger data sets and learn to cull through that.
Yeah, I think you're correct when you say it's not the evidence, it's the data.
It's the data.
Yeah.
That's it. 100%. Data is sexy to me.
It is a sexy word.
Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to catch up with Blondes and Booze, where they can go to follow all your research and become part of the community.
Well, Blondes and Booze are on every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Central. We're on Fridays at 7 p.m. Central. I'm also the co-host with Tex Wesson on Texas Front Porch on Mondays at 8 p.m. Central. And pretty much when we go out in the field, you know what we know because we show you everything.
Epic. Brandy, thank you so much for the time.
More
than a pleasure. I've seen you at a few conferences, and it's nice to finally get to sit down and talk.
Yeah, we're always so busy.
Yeah.
We never
get
to. Yeah,
exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So while you are online checking out everything from Brandy Butcher and Blondes and Booze, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all of our live coverage of events. That is where you can also like, follow, subscribe, share. Don't forget about our free Roku app where you can get all the episodes as well as some amazing binaural beat music. Stay tuned through this quick break. We will be right back with our continuing coverage of the Falk Monster Festival here in Falk, Arkansas, right after this. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Curious Realm's continuing coverage of the Falk Monster Festival, coming to you live from Falk, Arkansas. We are here at the table with one of our favorite researchers, one of our favorite guests, the amazing Ryan Edwards was here speaking about his new book, Sasquatch, A Prehistory of a Living Legend. And this book is filled with such amazing stuff, man. I love your work because you, much like King Gerhard, come at it from the point of view of zoo and then crypto. You know, let's look at things in the point of view of like, could an environment sustain a species of this size? Those kind of things first.
Yeah, like that's one thing that really we don't talk about a lot in this field is that ideas of zoology and ecology. Mm. Like crypto ecology, that should be a thing right there. Like,
yes.
For instance, when people bring up, oh, I have Dogman and Bigfoot on my property. That's not likely because they would compete each other to extinction. Like, there's ideas of carrying capacities.
Mm.
Like, an environment can only carry so many animals. It can only have so many large predators and, like, niches. That's something that is not talked about with cryptozoology.
Yeah.
Like, if Sasquatch is real and it's a living, breeding species, what's its niche? What does it eat? How does it exist? Where does it exist? What type of environments? That's something that really isn't discussed a lot, which I believe should be discussed. And not with just Sasquatch, but all types of cryptids. Like, for instance, we bring up the Dogman phenomena.
Mm.
At one point, when I was younger, I thought Dogman was a physical living, breathing creature. I know now I'm wrong, because it can't exist. It's ecologically can't exist, because it's seen in the same areas as Bigfoot and, like, bears. They outcompete each other. Secondary is like how it looks. The adaptation of bipedal locomotion on a digitigrade is very unlikely. Very unlikely. So if you look at the like morphologies, the behaviors, and the ecology of certain cryptids, they simply can't exist in a physical realm. That's the thing.
Mm.
They can exist. Maybe something more spiritual, metaphysical. But
sure.
Something else, not zoological.
Yeah, and that's a topic that we've discussed numerous times, not only on the show, but with you, is the idea that, yes, I believe that there is a large hominid species roaming the forests of North America and beyond.
Yeah.
But I also believe in these other phenomena. I believe, because I'm an experiencer myself, Ryan, I have had my experiences that, like, people were right there. And didn't have, like, I was just in the car the other day with somebody who was, like, physically no further away than me, than you and I, when I had the religious experience that moved me to enter the seminary. Like, when I was in what I know to be the true presence of God, and I looked him in the eye, and I was like, were you there with me? Did you see that? Was it quantifiable to you?
Yeah.
Were any of the other 500 people at Mass that day in that moment with me? Like, none of the other altar servers experienced it. You know, it was my experience. So I am prone to believe any experiencer until proven otherwise.
Yes.
And yeah, I believe that much like you're saying, that these things are much more paranormal in nature, maybe along the lines of the fae, fairies, things like that, where they are more than willing to adapt and change to whatever you would be okay with.
No, like me and Jason McLean were having a conversation about that actually on the way here.
Mm.
The ideas of Sasquatch.
Yeah.
There's ideas that they braid horses' hair and that they make these nests and things like that. Do you know what those would have been called in Europe a couple hundred years ago? Fairy knots.
Yeah.
The idea is that the fairies would tie horses' hair and things like that together.
Mm.
And then nowadays, we're just moving it from fairies to Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Or think about, you know, like the black shuck. The ideas of like black, of like demon dogs, hellhounds in ancient Europe and Britain. Nowadays, what do we get? Black panthers.
Yeah.
That appear and disappear out of nowhere. Is this the exact same phenomenon, but just changed species?
Mm.
Or is it not? Because like one thing like with the black panther phenomena and the ABC alien big cats.
Yeah.
Why are they almost always black panthers? Like, we knew for sure the alien, the Big Cat Removal Act in 1970, all big cats, a lot of them were released into the wilds of, like, Great Britain.
Yeah.
Tigers, lions, ocelots, cheetahs.
Really?
Leopards.
Really?
But why do we only get sightings of the black cats now? People don't talk about seeing leopards. People don't talk about seeing
tigers,
ocelots and tigers. Just primarily black felines. So, which is understandable if they survive, but why wouldn't the other ones survive?
Well, and once again, when you start looking back at the history of the area and seeing things like the black dogs, things like that. I mean, Sherlock Holmes, the Hound of the Baskervilles, is based on that lore.
Like the ideas are like of the black shuck back in the day. The stories of that, like, it would go into like a church and the call marks are still there today.
Yeah.
What if instead of black shuck, now we have the Beast of Exmoor, the Beast of Bodmin Moor, the Surrey Puma? I'm not necessarily saying these.
Gévaudan?
Basically, Gévaudan, that's French.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily saying these animals are not there physically. Of course, there's physical animals. There's animals.
Sure.
There's depredation of livestock. There are footprint finds, things like that. But there's a lot of phenomena occurring alongside it that doesn't make any sense zoologically. Like, there's signs of them just disappearing out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So maybe there's two, like what I say a lot, there's two things happening here. There's more than one thing occurring. There has to be something that's like zoological, but there's something else happening. Like the same thing with Sasquatch. Me, in my opinion, Sasquatch is a physical, living, breathing creature. But what happens when you see a Bigfoot in the middle of your room? Or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Or when you see, as we've said before on the show with you, like when you see Bigfoot walk through a portal or walk out of one. Now you're looking at two totally separate phenomena occurring simultaneously. And at which point do you start investigating? Do you investigate the portal first or do you investigate the Sasquatch first?
Yeah.
You know, because you've got a branched investigation there and you have to figure out one of the anomalies before the other.
Yes.
You know, which are both pretty hard provable. And that's a conversation that we were having with Brandy Butler a while ago, or Butcher rather, from Blondes and Booze, was I am semantically getting away from the term evidence. I am dropping that from my vocabulary because evidence to me is what you give your lawyer to say, this will exonerate me. This will set me free.
Yeah.
So unless a picture is to the point of that, it's data.
Yeah.
And scientifically, we need to be increasing the data field, gathering more points of data.
Yeah. Like, that's what I talked about a little bit in my lecture, because we had a little Q&A, and one question was like, if I'm doing field work, what should I do? And I'm like, well, remember, collect data.
That's right.
Collect it properly. If you go in and don't collect it properly, don't do the right channels, things like that,
yeah.
then it's no longer scientific.
Yeah.
If we keep it scientific to the nose, that's what we need. Like, of course, a good friend of ours, Shelly Covington to Montana,
yeah.
always talks about that.
That's like, right. I love her.
Citizen scientists.
Of that's right.
There's a proper procedure on how yeah. to collect data. If yep. you don't do that correctly, then it's not true data.
Well,
it's skewed.
And even to the point, like we were talking with Chester Moore earlier, the fact of you're out in the field investigating for a week, you've gathered a sample. How do you procure that and make sure that it's still viable for lab use after yeah. you're out in the field with it for a week? Yeah. How do you make sure it doesn't get contaminated? How do you make sure that it doesn't get deprecated DNA-wise? Things like yeah. that. Are you taking those steps with your points of data?
Yeah.
You
like,
know?
For instance, I brought up, like, okay, one big thing that we're really big into right now is eDNA, environmental DNA. Okay, cool. You have a Sasquatch print. Don't cast it immediately. Grab a piece, grab some dirt from the bottom of it.
Yeah.
See if you can possibly get eDNA.
Mm-hmm.
But it also brings in the question of, there's another question that was pointed to me that I liked. What do you think is going to prove that some of these species exist?
Yeah.
Because technically, there are labs that have gotten back unknown primate DNA before.
Yes, there
but
are.
Yet, has Kins 5 talked about finding Bigfoot or Fox News? Oh, we discovered Sasquatch. No.
No.
So DNA is not the whole thing.
But we also, like, there were just new species of primates discovered in Borneo. Yep. Like, these discoveries are ongoing. It's not like we've discovered all primates yeah. across the globe. You know, it's not like we've discovered all marine life across the globe. So we can totally ward, you know,
yeah.
totally cut out Nessie. Totally cut out Ogopogo. Totally cut out Champ. You yeah. can get rid of them. We've discovered all the sea life. Like, no, we haven't. Like, not even in our lakes and no. rivers have we discovered all the life. So this is science. It's ongoing. The day it becomes static, it's no longer science.
It's dogma.
It's dogma.
You want to stay away from dogma and, like the ideas of, like, changing and adapting and evolving.
Right.
Like, for instance, like, it's getting brought up a lot today of, like, me being one of the youngest researchers in the field.
I love it.
But also that brings up different ideal points, different ideas.
That's right.
Of like maybe this new next generation could bring in new ideas.
It's fresh ideas, and that's yeah. just it. That's what's necessary in science is the fresh perspective. And I say it regularly on the show. I am glad that UFO was relabeled to UAP.
Yeah.
Because once you include phenomena, now science cannot ignore it. It's their yeah. due diligence and their duty to explore that 5% anomaly in the experiment.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, what was the anomaly? I don't know. Did you investigate it? Nah. What?
It's
you know?
Like, you
like that's literally the job of an experiment.
Yeah. And, like, that brings in the ideas of, like, the science in this. Like, one thing I always bring up is, like, ology is in the word of cryptozoology.
That's right.
Ufology. It's about the science.
It's a study.
It's a study. It's of, like, okay, how can we go in here and not just be a bunch of rednecks with guns going out there looking for Bigfoot.
And that brings up a very good point because, and I want to marry that and loop it back to a thought that you just mentioned, which is one of the youngest published cryptozoologists out there. I'm not going to say that there aren't other people yeah. out there doing field work. I'm not going to say that there aren't other people out there doing hard, good research. But you're one of the youngest published
yeah.
cryptozoologists out there. Two books, Nether, almost finished. At the age of 23. And my brother and I, we come from a teaching family. You're a teacher during your day job. It's one of those, if like, the example I give is when I walk into a Knights of Columbus meeting.
Yeah.
You typically think Knights of Columbus. The old guys with the fish fry. Well, because they're a bunch of old guys.
Yeah.
And when I walk in at a year and a half under 50, they're like, whoa, look at the young buck. Make sure and buy him a beer so he sticks around, man. Like, he'll yeah. bring his buddies. Like, if I'm the young one that you're courting, you need to go to a younger demographic if yeah. you want this to go on another 30 years.
Yeah.
And you like, know? Because yeah. my 30 is going to be 80. I'm going to be the dude like, oh, look at that 50-year-old young buck. Let's get yeah. him in here. Like, we need people your age to be enthused about
yeah.
this.
And like, that's the thing is, like, I've seen there's a couple of good researchers out there. Mm-hmm. People like Nate Brislin,
yeah.
Emily Fleur, that they bring in new perspectives and they're younger in their 20s. And I'm like, okay, that's what we really need.
That's
is
it.
Like, I would love, like, this is something I brought up to like different conferences. Have a newcomer speaker.
That's right.
Like have one slot open for someone that maybe has never spoken before or someone that's just getting into the field. Because a lot of times, too, it's the ideas of like, oh, I'm out there with Lyle Blackburn. I'm out there with Ken Gerhard. I don't want to do it. I want to walk away. Like, I'm not big enough for this. But yet, a lot of researchers have that idea. And it's like, no, bring out your ideas. Like, even if they're different from the people that have it, bring it out.
Well, and it's the fact of, in a lab, if you're in a lab setting, if you're not challenging the data at hand, if you're not challenging the experiment, if you're not poking and prodding from a different direction, you're not getting new data.
Yeah.
You know, you're rehashing old data all the time, all the time, all the time. And that's why, you know, like Tex Wesson, who's speaking right now, was saying like, I was like, did you get your stories today? He's like, I got about 6 or 7 good ones last night. Yeah. You know, because people like him, he's writing books and doing shows about people's experiences specifically. Yeah. I talk to mainly researchers, authors, that kind of stuff in the field. People like him and Josh and that kind of stuff talk to a lot more experiencers and gather a lot more stories. And that in and of itself is a whole different realm of data.
And you need to get that marriage of like, that's why I work with techs a lot. Because I'm like, okay, cool. I think this. What have your eyewitnesses said?
Exactly.
Like, for instance, I'll give you a best example. Handprints. For this newest book, I was doing a section on handprints. And I was like, wait, Tex, you have a couple eyewitnesses that talked about leaving handprints, right? I'm like, cool, can I see the data? And he showed me, and I'm like, I looked at the pictures. I'm like, wait, that supports my hypothesis. Okay, this doesn't support my hypothesis. Okay, it's that talking from the researcher.
That's right.
To the actual, like, field researcher.
Yes.
Like, I'll admit it. I am an armchair researcher to an extent. I don't really do the field work as much.
You're a library researcher.
Yeah.
Which is utterly necessary.
Yeah. You need both.
That's right.
That's why I try not to let other people judge other, like, researchers. Like, oh, you go sit in the library? Oh, you're not a real researcher.
Well, that's like saying that the theoretical physicist that designs the rocket isn't as necessary as the dude who physically built the engine and motor and the rocket.
Yeah. And also, it's funny, too, because, like, also the ideas of, like, one big thing with this is the ideas of ego.
Yeah.
Because think about that. Who gets all the fame and fortune from that?
Yeah.
The astronaut in the rocket ship.
That's right. That's right.
It's the people that are in the field that get a lot of the attention that some of the researchers that in the background don't really get.
That's right.
Yeah. I think that's why a lot of people try to get away from that. They want to go towards like the sensationalistic aspects of like going in the field, hunting monsters, and getting all these stories and being a good storyteller. Yes, that's a part of it. But the real science of it is doing the legitimate field work. And being behind the scenes saying, okay, I have all this data. What does this data say?
Well, and very much like whenever we've interviewed Adam Davies on the show about his expeditions, the stories is where he starts.
Yeah.
He ain't going somewhere to search for the Yeti in the Himalayas if there aren't locals talking about having seen a Yeti.
Yeah.
But at the same token, he takes that, then starts looking at the region in the area, and will it support that animal?
Yeah.
Will it support this? Could this viably be there? And if those two things don't jibe, we ain't going to the Himalayas.
Yeah.
You know, like that's parts one and two of the equation. You know, that's like building a wall without a foundation.
Yeah.
You know? So you start with the stories. You start with tribal stories, things like
that.
For
instance, with me, like with cryptozoology, one thing I look at is First Nation stories. Like
absolutely.
Old, indigenous oral traditions. If this cryptid, like, bring up the rake, for instance.
Mm.
They only came out the last 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
There's no old traditions of it, then the likelihood of it existing is very unlikely in my eyes. Like, most cryptids I research have an old tradition. Thunderbirds, Sasquatch, to an extent Dogman, but it's primarily a recent occurrence. A lot of these lake monsters, the Shunkawawakeen, the Wahila, have a old tradition that go back hundreds or even thousands of years. But yet, things like the rake, to an extent, like all these other like creepypasta style cryptids, have only come out in the past 20 years. And know what's also come out recently? The internet.
That's right.
These are what I like to call internet cryptids. Ones that have kind of taken over cyberspace, and now I've taken up people's minds.
Well, and a prime example of that is what we know as Chupacabra, you know? What we know as Chupacabra, it's why when people see, like, the Texas Blue Dogs and the Chupacabras that we have here in Texas, they're like, that's not the Chupacabra. It's like, yes, because the one you're talking about is the one from Puerto Rico that made its fame on the internet when people like Craig Woolheaders started Crypto Mundo.
Yeah, that's the thing is, like, I also bring this up, and so does Ken. Chupacabra, goat sucker, it's describing a characteristic, a behavior, not a physical description.
Exactly.
So you can say anything's a chupacabra if it's eating
exsanguinating
goat's blood. Yeah. Do you even say, oh, that guy's drinking goat blood? He's a chupacabra.
Yeah.
It's a behavior, not a physical description.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And you know, I know it seems very semantical, folks, but it's important to make the differentiations. It's important to recognize the differentiations.
Yeah. Like, one thing I brought up with the presentation today was nomenclature. Mm. The idea is of colloquial names. Like, I've gotten plenty of times where people are like, oh, yeah, the Sasquatch of Canada and the Bigfoot of the United States. I'm like, what do you mean? So, yeah, Sasquatch is seen in Canada. It's not seen in the United States. I'm like, it's the same thing. It's just different names. Yeah. Or like the Ohio Grassman, Falk Monster, the Honey Island Swamp Monster, Skunk Ape. All these aren't just different types of Bigfoot. They're all the same thing, but just different names for it.
Yeah.
Puma, Mountain Lion, Catamount, Felis Concula, all the same thing. It's a cougar, but just by different names.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. I mean, it goes into fisheries. Everything is like that, where there are colloquial local names. Like, I'm a Cajun. We call freshwater white drum Gasper Goo. Hmm. They're just a white drum. Like, hey, white drum. I'm like, no, we call it a Gasper Goo. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
You know? So that exists all over the place. And it is important to understand that. And it's important to know that, yes, they may be talking about a local variety or variation of an animal, a morphology of an animal, but it's the same, pretty much the same species or subspecies.
Yeah. Or, like, how many times I get so annoyed by this, like, someone sees a white Bigfoot. Oh, I saw the Yeti. I'm like, you didn't see the Yeti. You saw a white Bigfoot. You saw a Sasquatch with white fur.
Yeah.
Just because it has white fur doesn't mean it's a Yeti. And also, technically, the Yeti didn't have white fur in the first place. That's something that came around because of Rudolph.
That's right.
Abominable, because, oh, it's white, it lives in the snow, white fur. Everyone thinks Yeti's white now. No,
that's right.
They have red or black fur.
Yeah.
But someone sees a Sasquatch deep in the mountains. Oh, I saw the Yeti. It's like, no. Yeti's a Tibetan name used in Tibet.
Yeah.
It's like almost like a
Yowie.
A cryptid cultural appropriation almost.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, don't use the wrong name for the same, for a different type of creature.
Yeah, you could say you saw a Yowie too. It's the same thing, just in Australia.
Yeah.
You know? And that's just it. These things have been reported for generations across mankind, throughout time. And it's interesting to see. One of the things you brought up, as we wrap up this segment, one of the things you brought up in your talk today, which I really loved, was the longevity to discovery. The idea that we heard about lowland gorillas, we'd heard stories of them. We didn't actively discover them until 100 years later.
No.
You know? And though there have been cultural stories of Yeti, Sasquatch, Yowie, what have you, across the globe, what we know publicly and majoritively across the globe only really came about in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't hit that 70-year time frame.
For instance,
yet.
Like the Abominable Snowman.
They
only came around like the 20s and the 30s, thanks to like Europeans going to the Himalayas for the first time.
That's right.
And hearing stories of this Yeti or the Tengu or Tengu, whatever creature they were using, the Almo, and then it got bastardized into Abominable Snowman.
Yeah.
And then but for a while, they were doing a lot of expeditions. But like with a timeline of discovery, we haven't hit that timeline discovery for Sasquatch yet.
Yeah.
Like, we're collecting the data still. We're still finding out what this thing is. Then we can try to discover it. Because, how can you ever try to discover the animal if you don't know exactly what it is? If it's a human-like primate, okay, there's certain things we can do. If it's an ape, there's certain things we can do. That's why, like, when my research into like the origins of Sasquatch and what it really is. A lot of people are like, well, that's not necessary. You just research it. Well, I want to know what I'm researching.
Yeah, you've got, well, and that's just it. You can't, you, it's a lot easier to hit the dartboard in the dark if you know what a dartboard looks like.
Yeah.
You know the basic shape and size.
Yeah.
Where it should be on a wall. No. Then you can turn the lights off and take a shot in the dark. But you got to have some bases there, you know, and that's just it. When it comes to this information and finding it and gathering it, it's the fact of looking at things with new eyes, being willing to let things go, being willing to let new ideas come in.
Yeah.
You know, and especially when it comes to involving the next generation, involving the future generation with this, and getting them interested beyond the point of red circles, interested beyond the point of pareidolia, interested to a point of science is sexy, Ryan, is what I want to say. I would love to see, like, okay, before we end the 10 o'clock news tonight, hey, just so you know, they turned light into matter. That's a pretty sexy story, everybody. Let's talk about that. Like, you don't hear that at the end of the news. Yeah. You don't hear new species discovered.
It kind of comes across like romanticized. Yeah. Like you have like, a lone researcher going in the jungles late and like discovering a whole new species. It's not like that. We're not Indiana Jones in here.
Yeah.
It's like
nobody's researching this in a vacuum because you can't research in a vacuum.
Yeah. So like you kind of have to bring in that tantalizing, like the romanticize it to an extent, but at the same time still grounded, keep it grounded.
Yeah. And that, to loop this right back to the beginning, that is what I love about your work. That is what I love about this book, is how well grounded and how well founded it is. Yes, there is hypothesis in here, because science requires hypothesis. That's quite literally the first step of science. With no hypothesis, there is no science. Yeah. So if you aren't thinking outside of the box, you aren't doing science, you know. Absolutely incredible stuff. Thank you, as always, for coming on, man. I love our conversations. I love when we get to hang out like this.
Yeah.
Let everybody know where they can get their copy of Sasquatch, A Prehistory.
Of course.
As well as your other book, Cryptids of the World.
Yep. If you want to check out Cryptids of the World or Sasquatch of Prehistory, check it out on Amazon. Look up Ryan Edwards. I did look up the titles. You're going to easily find them there as well. Sasquatch of Prehistory. It was created by David Weddeley's publishing company, Eerie Lights. If you look up Eerie Lights, it'll probably be one of the first books to come up. It's fairly new. Only got published back in March. So, right off the presses, you'll be probably some of the first people to get it.
Absolutely awesome, man. Once again, thank you so much for speaking today. It was a fantastic, fantastic presentation. I love your work. I cannot wait to see what the next book brings about. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Ryan Edwards and getting his book, Sasquatch, A Prehistory of a Living Legend, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find all the books, videos, music, classes, all that good stuff by our guests. CuriousRealm.com/live is where you can watch us live every Tuesday. If you're a Roku user, make sure to download our free Roku app full of all the episodes as well as tons of live music, binaural beat and meditation tracks made by yours truly. Stay tuned through these quick breaks. When we come back, we will have more of our continuing coverage of the Falk Monster Festival right here in Falk, Arkansas, right after this, folks. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Curious Realm's continuing coverage of the Falk Monster Festival right here in Falk, Arkansas. We have the pleasure of being joined right now by our good friend and regular guest, Daniel Allen Jones from The Vortex. How you doing, bud?
Hey, Christopher. Great to be here with you another year here at the Falk Monster Festival.
Always great seeing you, man. You have been, let's just say, making the rounds lately. we have a stretch. Well, we're here in Falk, Arkansas right now, but right across the border about 10 minutes down the road in Texas, we have a stretch in April where there's like 3 weekends in a row, all the way from South Texas to West Texas to East Texas. And you hit up all of those. You hit up, kind of like me, a lot of events every year, being active in the community, being active in research. And it's always great seeing you. It's always great knowing that, like, hey, awesome, Daniel's here emceeing this year. It's going to be a great show.
Cool. Yeah, there's a lot to keep up with, you know, and I'm excited to be a part of it. And I do what I can to, you know, make time for everything that's out there. It's tough to keep up with, but it's cool to see that this and many other events are continuing to happen year after year, and people can get together and really work towards something interesting for a lot of people who are interested in this.
Well, and especially to have seen, this is my third year here at Falk. To have seen us move from the community center where we had dinner and the movie viewing last night to the junior high theater over here across the street, about 4 times the crowd size, you know, things like that. Like, it opened up a lot of things, and it's great to see that, like, there was no real hiccup in that. There was no, like, oh, we had a slow year moving things over, we didn't fill the house. Like, it transitioned over and grew immediately, and it's fantastic to see that.
Yeah, it's really, I think, a big part about what people are here to experience when they come. They want to be able to hear presenters in a way that can accommodate wherever you are in the room. Here at this location, it's something that, for those who have been at the event before, you'll notice an immediate difference. It's something that I think is an important part about being able to come in and be a part of the conversation, be able to listen to speakers. And when we were at the community center, we had the similar format. We had a smaller screen, but here we've got the projector. We've got a lot of seating that you can choose from, and whether you got the up row VIP section or you're just in the general admission, there's a lot of good viewership for those who are going to get and, you know, into the presentations and really kind of get a sense of where we're headed with some of that information. And I think it's something that we can continue to see develop over the course of the next few years as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And to see the communities develop, to see communities coming together, to see people coming together to help support the local community with the drawing, all that kind of good stuff, is fantastic. And you yourself, speaking of research, have been doing quite a bit of research into the Aurora crash of 1897. How's that been going?
Yeah, so I've been compiling material regarding the Aurora legend, which goes over 100 years back, and it's something that many people have kind of heard parts of. It's kind of deep-seated within the lore of ufology, or the study of UFOs, and so this is something that is near and dear to my heart, because not only do I live nearby, but I was first shown the locations of these historic sites by my buddy, the late Jim Mars. And he helped to share about this story years ago in some of his material that he wrote, a book, Alien Agenda. And so a lot of people found out about it that way. And he later appeared on some History Channel shows about the Aurora legend as well. So what initially happened was, back when we had an event in Aurora in 2016, we had put together some material to have a publication about the history of the legend and some of these things that he had done by way of investigating it back in the 70s. Even after all that time, there were still some living people who were alive back in 1897 who described either the events as a made-up story or that they were actually there and it happened or it didn't happen. But for those who aren't really familiar, in a nutshell, the Aurora legend is essentially an airship story from 1897. There are several airship stories at this time, and this one stands out because there really weren't anything, there weren't objects up there that we think of now as modern airplanes in a way that people should have been seeing much at all.
Yep.
Hot air balloons and things like that, blimps, they were kind of on the rise, but the idea of something like a lighter-than-air craft wasn't really in production as far as what's well-known until the Wright brothers just a few years later.
Yeah.
But the Aurora story is essentially one that stands out because it deals with not only a sighting, people observing this aerial object, but it allegedly crashes in the local town of Aurora there, and an occupant, supposedly the pilot, was discovered badly mangled. And it says that in the original newspaper, it was reported in the Dallas Morning News at the time, said that enough of the original was recovered, but it was determined that it was not an inhabitant of this world. which is an interesting idea considering at the time science fiction was sort of in its infancy and people were actually talking about beings and people from other worlds despite this idea that that was never really happening or a thing until much later. It really was something that was sort of in the social psyche, but not really as prevalent, obviously, as it is today.
Yeah.
But it's something that I think people wonder, was this inspired by ideas? Was it really a historical event that happened? Or was it just a made-up part of yellow journalism to an attempt to bring people into a dying town?
And I was going to say, that's something that we discuss with Dan Duke regularly whenever we have him on, because he's family relation to Jesse James, and happened to find out that, like, Jesse James faked his death and came to Texas and lived out the rest of his days. And oddly enough, the town where Jesse James was shot, not too happy about this news, you know, because, yeah, like that was the days, like you said, of yellow journalism where, like, you sold sensationalistic stories. This was the day and age where it was like, you know, let's do a whistle stop tour with Abraham Lincoln's corpse so that everybody can see him. You know, let's charge a dime to see the melted Iceman, to see the Fiji mermaid, things like that. It was the age of tall tale. It was the age of sensationalistic journalism like that, you know, so it is interesting. Was it the fact that there was a crash, or was it something to bring people into a town? You know, was there ever a rush of tourism to Aurora, other than the modern rush of tourism to Aurora?
Well, that's an interesting thing. You know, it seems like the idea for this story to have been concocted in a way to drive people in, you know, since can be made out of those ideas. But the challenge with that is that they never received any kind of big boom in tourism or anything that really helped them develop economically, as far as what's known. There were a lot of challenges that they faced at the time. There was a crop epidemic. They had a boll weevil situation, and they had a yellow fever, so a lot of people were dying. There was a mass exodus, and so people had considered that this story written by a man named S.E. Hayden had just been written because he was a writer for the local paper and wanted to be able to bring people back into his town. Mm. What I found out, and I don't know that anyone has really known about this, but looking through information, working with the local historical society there in Wise County, and going through documents dating back years, this man, S.E. Hayden, actually moved out of Aurora with his family soon after this story was written, moved to California, continued business there, which is where he ended his life. And I figured out where his gravesite is in California. I don't know if anyone ever has really taken the time to locate this or do anything about it, or that it really is all that relevant, but I find that connecting some of the dots of the historical pieces to this story have been fascinating to me, because I look at it not as much of a case that can be proven or disproven, although people can, you know, go into those directions all day long. I look at this more of a process of preserving cultural history of the legend as it's officially acknowledged on a Texas Historical Commission marker there at the Aurora Cemetery. Yeah. For nearly 50 years now, it's got a marker that recognizes is this whole story as a legend. And I like to approach it as such, or simply as folklore, rather than merely just an idea that it's historically sound and there's all this information to show it happened, or that it didn't, because the most people I encounter who know something about it are either one way or the other. So my effort going beyond this project that was initially a publication with my buddy Jim Mars is that it's evolved in some way to incorporate not just one view or another, but just whether it's fact, fiction, or folklore, to really bring together all of the ways in which the story has been featured in any multimedia platform, going from the original newspapers all the way through more modern media, to shows on television, network television. The History Channel was a big supporter, and in some way helping to get it out to the world. And so now you have all these things online, podcasts, all of this stuff that shows that this story is probably, maybe next to Roswell, one of the most publicized stories of an otherworldly encounter ever. And I think it's important to see that whether people are encouraged to try to find the truth of did it all really happen or not, it's something that I think can inspire us in some way because of how the story goes. And to kind of finish off, the whole idea of the story is that it wasn't just that sighting or just the crash or just the body, but it implies that the pilot, and in whatever way it was described, was given a funeral. And I think it's really important to see that these people, and if we look at it at face value or say it's all a hoax either way, it's nice to think that people can, regardless of heritage or origin or background or creed, all of these things, can put aside their indifference in some of this and really be respectful and honorable to put someone to rest that wasn't from the same place, wasn't of the same kind as far as the story goes.
Yeah.
And I think that says a lot to where we are today and where we could be going. And it's nice to think that it's a story of compassion and that they were able to find it within their heart to acknowledge that this was a being of some sort and, you know, give it a burial to honor and recognize its existence. And I think that's nice, but also, you know, it's just it's a story. And I treat it in that way because, you know, whether people ask all the time, why don't they just dig it up? And, you know, so people tried to exhume the body half a century ago and it didn't work out.
well, and let's get into that because, you know, as much as the story is storied, so is the landmarker, you know, and much like the Boggy Creek sign here in Falk, Arkansas, that goes missing regularly, you know, there have been numerous markers of this grave that have been moved, taken, stolen, all kinds of, even here recently.
Yeah.
There was the fact, was it Victoria Munday that had gone and you were like, hey, wait a minute, that stone's in the wrong spot.
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting situation. I was there on the anniversary just earlier before Victoria Munday, and she had shown a picture of just maybe 3 hours or so later, and this stone, this marker that had been put into place about 2015 by, at the time, the city administrator, Dr. Tony Wheeler, who I had worked with for a while. She was very much for the theme of the alien and the spaceship and incorporated that in this official city branding. And that was kind of neat to see where, for a long time, the city had struggled to come to terms with utilizing it in any way and or associating it being associated with that theme at all. So Tony, through part of the city's excavation process, came across a large stone boulder that they thought might be suitable to put on what she called Ned's grave. She called the pilot or alien Ned because as a little girl growing up in Aurora, one of the old timers' names was Ned. And so Ned would tell all the kids the story. And so because she was kind of connected to it that way, she affectionately called her little alien dummy, which was sort of the unofficial mascot, Ned. And so people all over the internet now refer to the alien pilot in Aurora as Ned because of that. And one of the interesting things is that this marker was there since 2015. And on the anniversary, just about a week ago, a little over a week ago now, on the 17th, this would have been the 127th anniversary of the legend.
Wow.
So I was there about 10:30 in the morning there in Aurora Cemetery. It's a 24-hour cemetery. And basically, I always do an update to show what it looks like at present. And the anniversary is kind of a significant day to show every kind of progression. And the stone was there. It looked normal. There was a few items. People leave trinkets and certain, you know, little tokens and things like that. And then a few hours later, she shared a picture that was completely different. And there were that large stone was not there. There were three headstones that looked like they were just officially put into place there and a little bit further down in a way that I assume is marking three previously existing unmarked burial plots that maybe did not have recognition before. And the stone was not stolen. It was just moved. I looked around. I actually came back later that night after work and found out that it was moved over by the entrance gate
to that area. Did you roll it back?
It's way too big for one person to move.
It's massive.
It's not something a lot of people realize, but the original headstone, what has been known as the original headstone, may not have actually even been there up until the early 70s.
Yeah.
So I've asked people there, the old timers living there now, about this stone and shown pictures of it that I got from Jim Mars.
Yeah.
It was there in the 70s and did see it. If they had ever known about this little crude hand hewn little rock with, you know, etching on it, if that had ever been there before the 70s, and the people I've talked to who have family there in that area say they don't recall a stone ever being there and that it's possible it got put into place in 1971 or two. Although maybe it was there the whole time since 1897. Although that doesn't seem to be able to hold up either, because the whole cemetery where it is now was not the original place of the cemetery they had in 1897. Everything was moved by a man and many people associated with the church at the time named Slimp. The guy named Slimp, who I was told by a society, historical society member, that there was no documentation of an alien pilot being transferred from cemetery to cemetery. It's just a fun bit of commentary there, but it's really interesting to see that, you know, that they really dug into this to see if there's any validity outside of the original news report. But what is important is that, coming back to the headstone, that headstone in the 70s, once newspapers were being written about it and it got republicized late 60s into the early 70s, it got national headlines. And dozens of newspapers were all over, not just in Texas, but all over the U.S. Were writing about this. The Associated Press picked it up. It was being repeated all over various newspaper publications, and it got a lot of attention. So people came to Aurora and brought metal detectors, were looking to do detecting on what they call the crash site and the burial site. And soon after this happened, the stone went missing after a cemetery watch was instilled. So people kind of wondered if someone, you know, came and exhumed the body themselves or did something. So that stone went missing in 1973. There's a reward, much more recent times, a reward offered from a lawyer in Dallas who's offering, at first it was like $1,000, now it's up to like $10,000 if it's still active. But there hadn't been a stone there for many years up until about 2011. Someone put a mock-up stone there in 2012, which showed a little bit of a spaceship etched on the stone. That stone was there for a good year, and then that one also went missing. So in 2014, that large one was put into place and had been there all the way up until just last week. And now, unless you know where it is, and if there's even anything there anyways, people will still probably go. So I don't know. I'm going to a meeting of the Cemetery Association, which is not associated with the city of Aurora, to see where things are with it and maybe get some answers, because people will continue to go there regardless. It should be also said that the large stone was not exactly in the exact spot as the old small one from the 70s. It was very close. I did some side-by-side analysis, and it's within feet, but the UFO hunters on the History Channel came in 2008, and they did some ground-penetrating radar and determined that there was a small child-sized grave. They couldn't determine the contents, but they showed that there was something. Whether it's an alien or dust or nothing, there was something in that site. So people kind of wonder, is there anything really there, and has it been exhumed already?
And that's a huge question, is has it been exhumed already? Was there anything there to begin with? And a lot of what we have been talking about on this show here today, as well as recently, Daniel, is the difference between data and evidence, and the passionate, necessary difference between data and evidence. There's a lot of data on this story. There are a lot of recounts. There's a lot of, you know, stories from locals, things like that. But it's interesting to see, like, once again, how frequently have they done any kind of radiography in the area to see, you know, if there's radiation. I know that the farmer who lived on the property where it supposedly crashed, like, somebody later developed some pretty awful tumors, whether or not it came from anything that was in the water in his well that he claimed or what. Who knows?
Well, I'm just going to mention on that for a moment. So the Oates family moved to the property there, which was previously owned by the Proctor family.
Yeah.
The Proctors were the ones who lived on that farm. J.S. Proctor had some sons. One of them was named Orion, interestingly enough. And Orion worked for, and I think they all did in some way, worked for a local print company. So some people had considered, because of their involvement in print and press, if they had some kind of role to play in having fun to concoct the story and all of this. But aside from that, I even was able to acquire an envelope with, on the back, it saying Orion Proctor Publishing, you know, on the back. So there, I mean, there's proof that they're a publishing family. And so it's really interesting to see that the history goes back in many different ways. But the Oates family, who moved onto the property, I was told in 1946, there's a lot of information out there that suggested it was earlier. Brawley Oates, who was the patriarch of the family at the time, brought his family there, cleaned out the well. The whole idea is that this airship crashed into the tower of a windmill, which was connected to a water tower and a well, and that the debris from which was discarded down the well, hauled off, or maybe just put it in the coffin for the burial. But the thing is that that well was reconstructed in 1946 by the Oates family, and there was some talk about them digging up and taking out some fist-sized balls of metal and just different pieces of metal. And I asked Brawley's son, Billy Oates, if he recalled anything, because he was there at the time, just this little boy, and he's still alive now. I've interviewed him, and he said he also drank out of that well probably as much as anyone else. And although a lot of newspaper accounts describe his father, Brawley Oates, saying that he incurred those unfortunate injuries and you know, looked like bad arthritis,
yeah,
from what he said was the alien spaceship and crash and all of that and the radiated well water. However, his family contests that big time. And even his son, Billy, Bill Oates, says that he drank out of that well and he might have a, you know, few arthritis problems, but nothing like his father. They say that was probably arthritis or gout, really bad, and that it had nothing to do with the water. But some of the early newspaper claims, and even Jim Mars would say that they were sharing that that's what happened because of the well water. So it's just it's a hit or miss situation depending on what information you go to. But Bill, he seems pretty straightforward, but he says, hey, I drank out of that well water too, and he showed me his hands. He says it might be swollen a little bit, but he said he was fine, and he didn't think that that was what caused it. While a lot of people online say it must be real because this person was affected by drinking it, we do know that it seems like people who are in close proximity to UAP or UFOs seem to get some kind of radiation. That has been documented. We do know that people incur effects, unfortunate ones. So there is sort of a physiological impact that people have when they're close to some unknown exotic material or objects. And whether that's the case here or not, I don't really think that there's enough evidence to support that. There's a lot of data to show different things, but it's really important to see that, as you mentioned, the difference between data and evidence is that sometimes people utilize data in an attempt to build evidence toward a case. And in this situation, that data has been utilized in a way to build a case towards describing Brawley as a victim of the well water, which, you know, is why he had those injuries. But I don't think that the real data is suggestive of that as hard evidence in a way that people would maybe want it to, despite it being kind of an unfortunate incident for him. His family's just been very adamant that that was all because it was something that he had prior and that just developed over many years. So it's one of those things that I think it gets conflated with the idea of it being a spaceship crash and aliens radiated water. It's fantastic. It's very sensational. But I think it's also important to respect that there's probably a more prosaic explanation to his health condition. It's unfortunate either way. And maybe there is something about the water, but you know, it's one of those issues where it's hard to really pin down now that it's after all these years.
Well, even if it was within that well, it would leach to surrounding areas. It would leach into table water. It would go further than just that isolated area if there was radioactivity inside of that, you know. And there's not really a whole lot of that there, let's say. There's not a whole lot of like hot zone going on in the area where it's like, hey, stay away from this. Look, the Geiger counter is going nuts. That kind of thing. And absolutely amazing story. And once again, one of the most fantastic stories in UFO UAP history right here, right down the road in Texas. And your research into it's been awesome.
Well, I would think that aside from it just being a UFO-related story, I try to branch out outside of just the UFO outlook, simply because even as a Texas legend, Texas folklore, it's probably one of the most widely recognized stories.
Yep.
Whether historians want to acknowledge that or not, it's probably a larger impacting folklore story than most traditional Texas folklore, simply because of how widespread it's become. And I think that that's an important part about how stories develop on their own, regardless of their authenticity. And that's a challenge for us to realize. Like, sometimes things we hear about in history didn't actually happen. Or yes. things that we find out are folklore, mythology, or urban legends and things like that, regardless of their authenticity, which that's fine to go in and look into as well, we can find their the veracity of those claims to be sound or not. The impact they have on society today is a completely different situation.
Yeah.
So I think that that's why it's really important to me to also explain that it's a story of compassion, of tragedy and compassion, and it's one of innovation because, you know, it deals with a lot of the other airship sightings, but in a way that stands out. And so what I've done is to not only compile that information, which was originally and intended to be a publication, people often look at that as a way of exploiting or commercialization. And so to allay any sense of concern for people who were wondering, you know, about this being some kind of a exploitative endeavor, I have just made an online database that's an encyclopedia where all this information can be stored and found available online for free called auroralegend.com. And then eventually the publication will be to follow that. If people do want to get it and have a physical copy, they can. And if they don't want to get that, they can just go on the website, and it works like a Wikipedia database, and you can find everything from the history, the chronology, the resources that allow you to see every possible way that it's been portrayed in media, investigated, and how we can utilize that information for the sake of preserving its history.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, when it comes to local history, when it comes to local legend, when it comes to keeping these cultural stories alive, that's what a lot of this is about, Daniel. You know, like, and the way these stories impact communities, the way that these stories change communities, it's something that we talked about with Craig Woolheater whenever he came on to promote Falk Monster Fest. It's something that we talk about whenever we have Lyle Blackburn on talking about Falk Monster. It's polarizing to a town. The town is 110% behind it and will throw a 20,000 person festival every year, or they want nothing to do with it, you know. And it's interesting to see that how it's very divisive. You know, there are many people in Falk who would rather the looky-loos not be here.
That's a great example. I mean, and I think Falk is a perfect parallel to it because you have people here right in town who have known about their whole life and maybe feel indifferent or want nothing to do with it or are here to celebrate it. And so it's something that, as we continue to see these developments with something like we're doing here this weekend, or you look at what people were considering 50 years ago when the movie The Legend of Balky Creek came out and wondered, huh, wow, this silly movie is just getting a lot of attention. Hopefully it'll go away someday.
Yeah,
and
here
we are all these years later, and it's huge. You have people like Lyle who have chronicled its history and is the biographer of the legend, and I think that's really important to see how something like this here, right here in this town, has a lot of rich history, and it's an opportunity for people to see that you can appreciate some of the lesser-known parts of history in a way that, whether they're looked at factually or as fiction or whatever it is, they inspire something, and
it allows us to celebrate
it and to explore it and to consider not just the mystery of the phenomena, but also to see how we work together and better together as people, as a community, and do what we can to find out how to make sense of some of these challenging things, which otherwise, as you mentioned, some people don't want anything to do with, but other times it brings people together.
And how to strike that point of common empathy in the middle, you know, because you aren't supposed to have a conversation trying to meet somebody at the end of the conversation. You're supposed to meet them where they're at, Daniel, you know, and we in society, whether we believe or disbelieve, it seems like we're always trying to convince somebody of our paradigm instead of meeting them where they're at and just having the conversation. Because the conversation is where we learn. The conversation is where we pull more points of data. It's when you get to open up that you find out more, not when you close down and go into a vacuum. So thank you, as always, for coming on the show. I always love having you on. You have such an astute outlook on these things. You are so studied and just so well put together with it.
I appreciate that, Chris. You know, if not anything else, it's made me find that not only is it very humbling, but it urges me to continue pursuing to study and to find out I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done that people, I think in many different avenues and arenas and disciplines can lend some help to. And this is a great example of how something like a city with a bit of folklore and history, whether, you know, we look at it seriously or not, can evolve into something that's very, helpful and innovative and a celebratory and a community type affair for the better. And I think it brings us together to explore these possibilities. And I think it's a great part to play in helping to connect people who otherwise have never seen the movie or been to Falk
right.
or know about any of these types of legends or monsters or cryptids, whatever it is. And I just wanted to also mention that you're helping to bridge the gap by providing some of the incredible things and benefits of production and media and sharing with the rest of the world who otherwise can't be here in person to enjoy
this
type of event.
That's right. And it's about getting word out there. Like I have a buddy that I traveled with on the road. And he was like, oh, my God, dude, I had no idea that you were involved with the Falk Monster Festival. It's like that, like, I'm all about the Falk Monster. Like, he makes films, he makes movies, and come to find out, like, it's one of them that, like, brought him to want to make movies. When I told him I was going to be hanging out with Lyle all weekend and things like that, he was like,
yeah.
Oh, my God. Like, oh, that's my jam. Like, I want to be there. And that's just it. It brings communities together. It brings people together. And speaking of bringing people together, I've got to bring you back to the stage because we're getting ready to wrap another presentation. You've got to get back to MC duties. Before we let you go, one more time, let everybody know where they can go to find out more about the Aurora Crash, where they can go to find out more about all of your work, Daniel.
Sure. So I'm redeveloping my main media platform, The Vortex, at thevortex.wiki. And you can also go check out all the history and information about the Aurora Legend at auroralegend.com. And I'm all over social media platforms, Facebook, X, Instagram, that sort of stuff. And I'm glad to, connect with anyone who's interested as well.
Absolutely. Daniel, thank you as always, my man. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Daniel Allen Jones and The Vortex, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share, comment, all that kind of good stuff. That's also where you can go to curiousrealm.com/videos and find all of the amazing videos from people like Daniel Allen Jones and all of our guests. When we come back from this quick break, we will have our final bit of coverage from the Falk Monster Festival right here in Falk, Arkansas, right after this, folks. Everybody, and welcome back to our waning coverage here at the 2024 Falk Monster Festival in Falk, Arkansas. We have the pleasure of being joined by former folklore professor Marvin Leeper. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
I'm so
pleased that you asked me to.
Oh, man, I loved your presentation a couple years ago when you got up and talked. That's the first time that I met you, was in the building across the street. You gave a great presentation today. You for years taught folklore.
Yes, I did.
Taught these concepts, and it's something that we talk about regularly on the show. We were just talking with Ryan Edwards about it a while ago, that people like Adam Davies, mm-hmm. before they go out in the field, folklore is where they start.
Yes.
He's like, if I don't have stories from tribes, from local people, things like that, telling me this thing has been there since before modern recording, I don't start.
Exactly.
And from there, if those stories don't have a basis, like, hey, this forest could support it, this water could support it, what have you, then we have no expedition. So it all starts with folklore. It all
does.
Starts with the story.
If you remember Anna Nikaris,
mm-hmm.
the anthropologist on Bigfoot, The Definitive Guide, she stated that she never goes looking for an unknown primate without that folklore of the indigenous peoples in the area to begin with. And then, as you said, and as I said in that presentation you're talking about a couple of years ago, we have to do the research on the research.
Yeah.
We have to look for justification. Okay, there are stories that have existed for X amount of years. That's great. That gives us a place to start. Then we have to do exactly what you said and look at the habitat. Could habitat support a creature like this?
Mm.
And then in the folk study, and I had an interesting time selling that curriculum to the Board of Regents.
Oh, I'll bet.
Yes, and I found a book by John Bertrand, who was a member of the American Folklore Society, more or less wrote the Bible, that there are three basic methods of folk study. The materialistic, and the footprints fit that. Something tangible we can touch.
Yeah.
There's the oral tradition, which are the stories that have been passed down for X amount of years.
Yeah.
And then we have ritualistic study, which is the Buquas dance, the cave paintings, things of that nature.
Yeah.
And I was quite surprised and pleased, of course, to learn that this actually does fit legitimate folk study. So I presented, I think I wrote up about three pages.
Well, and it's interesting because one of the things we were speaking about with Ryan Edwards earlier is the idea that, you know, when you start looking, especially across the globe, there are familiarities through so many of these stories, especially once you start talking Sasquatch and paranormal, the modern phenomena that's happening of, hey, I saw a portal open up in the woods and a Bigfoot walked out, or I was standing there and Dogman popped up and then he disappeared into smoke. A lot of these stories have very much the same echoes of fairy, things like that, and even a lot of the warnings of tribes whenever it comes to an Eretka, because it's not like they said, like, oh, these things exist. There are some tribes that say, like, oh, these things came to our ceremony regularly. Oh, we had trade with these things. Whatever you do, kids, if they offer you a salmon, don't go in the woods with them. You know, and very much, once again, akin to those stories of fairies, things like that, where it's like, notice this, but beware this. And those behaviors seem to be very similar.
They, in indigenous peoples especially, per tribe, have different views and takes on what Sasquatch may or may not be. And in, for instance, in Oklahoma, as I said in the presentation earlier, as early as 900 AD, the Caddo Nation were telling of tales of these things, who were giants, cannibals, that preyed upon their women.
Yep.
Then in other tribes, they're benevolent forest protectors. So it's interesting from place to place to look at the cultural differences on their take, their perspective of this collective creature. But they all contain the same elements, which we discussed earlier, that we can study. And in the oral tradition, they are often cautionary tales, or there's a moral behind them. So Claude Levi-Strauss said that the really real was what our perceptions of reality, individual perceptions of reality, can be. So individually, those tribes, those cultures, would look at Sasquatch as per their needs. If they were using them in the oral tradition, and stories do change.
Sure.
The story of the LaFleur incident up in Oklahoma, to where one of these creatures was stealing corn from the cribs, I've heard four different versions of it. So in the oral tradition, it's like playing the game of telephone. You know, you can tell one person something, and by the time it gets to the end, it's changed and morphed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are different versions of the same tale being told over time.
Yeah, well, and, you know, it's an example that we give regularly biblically.
Absolutely.
Is when you start looking at the mission, once the apostles were given their mission, John says, you know, don't wear shoes, wear only the shirt on your back. You know, James says, hey, wear only the sandals on your feet and bring a walking stick. Same exact story, but it depends on who you're telling it to because, well, Corinthians may not have had sandals. And these people may not have used walking sticks.
In the Synoptic Gospels, as you mentioned, there's that version of it. And then in the Gentile, you know, Luke, his version slightly differs.
Exactly.
But it's all the same message.
Yeah, it's all the same core message. It's all the same core belief. Yes. It's that this has been colloquially changed so that it makes sense to the localized people.
Exactly.
Now, when that starts happening, especially let's transport this concept of folklore, because so often, unfortunately, Marvin, I think we get stuck with the idea of folklore being antiquated, folklore being gone, being in the past.
But we're making folklore now.
Exactly.
Even today.
Yeah.
At this conference. In the future, this will be added to the lore.
Yeah.
So, yes, we're making folklore.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Precisely. Precisely.
It's an ongoing process.
Yeah. And even it's something that we brought up with Saffron Cannon, who's set up right down the road over there.
The artist?
Yeah. She did a whole book, 6 feet away, about the Falk monster and about her father's sighting of the Falk monster, you know, and how, hey, kids, you shouldn't be afraid to have the experience of the Falk monster, you know. And how do you pass that down? How do you make sure that these stories get passed down to the next generation, that they get carried on if you don't talk about them, if you're not willing to talk about them?
Because the primary vehicle for keeping these stories alive over the centuries has been the oral tradition.
Yeah.
Now we have social media and everything, and when we find these tales, we want to record them for posterity, as soon as possible by whatever media possible.
Mm.
And that will help in the preservation, but ultimately you're absolutely correct. It will be the oral tradition that continues to reflect these stories.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. Because come down to it, how good are books? How long do they last?
Yeah.
You know, like, unless we're carving it in stone or crystal or something like that, it's this that's going to carry it forward.
Yes, exactly.
It's the conversation.
And there you have the materialistic carving it into stone.
Yeah.
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 The oral tradition. And then, of course, the ritualistic, which, as we discussed, may vary from culture to culture.
Well, and, you know, that's something that specifically we get into regularly with our guest Keith Seeland, who works in the world of petroglyphs, mm-hmm. and the idea that petroglyphs are different than rock art.
Well,
you know, rock art is a story. Like, hey, here's the hunt that we had 3 days ago. This was epic. Like, we got 3 days to get back to camp. Like, let's preserve this in the cave. Petroglyphs, however, are different because they're expressing a religious tradition. They're expressing a sacredness of a specific spot, mm-hmm. and told in a totally different type of oral tradition.
Absolutely.
And carried forth
Absolutely.
In a different way.
And oddly enough, even though they change as well,
sure.
we're talking about,
they evolve.
Those that are of the religious nature seem to contain the greater degree of continuity.
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely.
I found to be quite amazing.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm in the midst of working on an album right now called Within the Rocks. And my whole concept was that, These very common patterns that you see in petroglyphs, the square shape patterns, the sawtooth patterns, the waves, that these were actually drawn by synesthetics who
Absolutely.
Who were drawing a representation of what they heard. Now recently I actively saw an article from Live Science. I shared it all over. Like, if you've been listening to any of the interviews I've been doing on shows about my new album, like, they've decoded the fact that some of these, specifically the square ones, are the drumming pattern.
Mm-hmm.
They're the, like, they have recorded, like, so this is the sacred spot, this is the ceremony spot, here's your drumming pattern,
yeah.
person, like,
incredible.
Here's your actual musical notation this, to carry yeah. forth here's, the ceremony.
Here's your sheet music.
Like, and when you look at them, like, if I'm an electronic musician, so I'm used to seeing waveform, like, pulse rate of a square wave, boop, 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 boop. And, yeah, it's the exact same thing if you're looking at drum tablature.
That's incredible.
You know, and it's That's really incredible. Interesting to see that, like, they took the effort to record, like, this is how you should drum at this spot.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that an
it's beautiful
testimony?
Yeah.
To the
yeah.
power. Yes,
and,
absolutely.
And the fact that it took us this long.
Yeah.
To decode it.
Yeah.
That, like, even tribal people there locally didn't remember
and another,
that that's what it was
another
for.
Another thing that you bring out there that's also quite interesting is the importance across cultures of
yes.
the drum.
Yes.
You know, Stonehenge.
Yeah. Yep.
In the center, they drum and reverberate off
yeah.
the hinges.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the fact that that's something that I talk about regularly on my show is that ancient cultures had two things above us. Number one, they were way more connected with the earth and their surroundings. When,
yes.
when the sun went away, you saw the Milky Way. You didn't just see a few select stars
yes.
like you see now.
Right.
You saw the panoply of the beautiful creation up there. You were tied to that, Marvin. If you did not know when that star rose, you didn't know when to hunt. You didn't know when to plant.
Absolutely.
You didn't know when to reap. Like, your whole life revolved around the sun, the moon, and the stars. Even my grandparents, Grew up in rural Louisiana.
Did they plant by the zodiac signs?
Good. They planted by the season.
Yeah,
they knew by when things were coming around, and hey, that flower is coming up. Time to put something in the ground.
Right. Exactly.
You know, we got about 2-3 weeks before rain starts hitting heavy. Like
that knowledge, fortunately, still exists, but it's been lost.
It's in a farmer's almanac now. We've been collecting it for hundreds of years since the days of Ben Franklin, and it's amazing to see, like, yeah, pretty funny. These native people knew this stuff a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they were making terra preta in South America and other parts of the world that's still better than our soil today that is demineralized.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
And so, yeah, the fact of these things being passed on are important. We have to keep the conversation going. I say it at the end of my show all the time, and you'll hear it in just a minute. Without the conversation, we stymie as humanity.
That's it. If
we aren't willing to meet somebody where they're at with the point of conversation, we're the ones with the problem.
Absolutely. We have to share knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, epistemology demands that we share our results.
The fact that you just said epistemology is what I love.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been quite impressed by this interview.
Well, thank you.
That you have put into this.
Well, it's the fact of, you know, I'm about the conversation, Marvin, and evidence is what exonerates you.
Absolutely.
Data is what we're after. We're after points of data to add to a data field. That's science. Once you lose the fact of points of data, now you're talking dogma.
Mm-hmm.
You're no longer talking hypothesis, which is the basis of science. If you aren't thinking outside of the box, you got a problem, scientist. That's part number one is hypothesize. Think the craziest thing you can.
Yeah, you can.
Now experiment, poke and prod. Move to theory.
Null or reject. Accept.
Through
whatever.
Further poking and prodding and experimentation, that theory will become law. Like, that's how science works.
And that is an approach I've noticed with, like, Ryan's presentation.
Mm.
That
I love
younger,
that kid.
Younger people are going into it with more of that mindset. And older folks like I are sometimes, I'm not myself, obviously haven't been in academics for years, but older people are less, they're reluctant to accept new methodology.
Mm.
And that's what the future is all about.
Yeah, yeah. The example that I give all the time is I turn 50 in a year. When I walk into a Knights of Columbus Hall, to hear people go, oh, look at that young buck. Make sure to buy him a beer so he sticks around. I'm not the demographic you should be searching for,
Absolutely.
Man. You need Ryan's age.
Mm-hmm.
You need 23, 25-year-olds to have the verve of this to carry it for the next 30 years.
You've got it by the tail.
Because like he said, the lowland gorilla was talked about. We didn't discover it till 100 years later. The modern version of Sasquatch that we know of is less than 70 years. We still have a 30-year gap till that point of discovery.
People, just
we've got to be willing to have the conversation.
I think awareness is, or lack of awareness, perhaps, is probably the culprit in acceptance. But you're absolutely right. If we don't have that conversation, then how can people...
It'll be too late come time for the conversation, you know? And conservation is a prime example, you know? Like,
absolutely.
We tried screaming conservation back in the 70s, save the wetlands, save the mountain lands, things like that. What do we have now? Grizzly bears in apartment complexes, coyotes in cities, cougars roaming around in the back alleys of L.A., you know? How long before it's a Sasquatch digging through your neighborhood dumpster?
Absolutely.
Because you've encroached on their land.
And there are tons of stories of just such that.
Exactly.
You know, and as a matter of fact, there is a state park in Oklahoma. The curator there won't tell anybody that his own personal belief about what's going on. But privately, he'll say, yeah, we call them park squatches.
Yeah.
And I said, why? He said, because they dig through the cans like the bears.
Yeah.
And I
it's
said,
easier.
Really?
It's easier.
And he said, yeah. He said, he hears the slamming of a large dumpster quite regularly and noticed it's been rummaged the next day.
Wow. Wow. Incredible.
There are some just tons of stories like that.
Well, and without folklorists like you carrying those on to the next generation, carrying those on, it's hard to keep it moving, Marvin. So thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for passing on the ideas of folklore and the importance of it to next generations. It's absolutely essential.
And so might I at our podcast like this.
Thank you. Thank you. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to keep up with research, where they can go to find you, contact you, all that kind of good stuff.
Currently without social media.
No problem with that.
I'm working through jerryhestand.com.
Okay.
And Jerry's going to be adding new content here in just a few days. We've been on several missions.
Cool.
And we're going to be adding some new content to Jerry's page. And my Folklahoma YouTube will be announced on jerryhestand.com.
Awesome.
We're going to try to have that thing up and going by June.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you for taking the time in this waning coverage that we have here at the Falk Monster Festival. Greatly appreciated. It was great to sit down and talk with you this year.
Yes, sir. It was a wonderful experience in my book as well, because it's nice to know that in social media there are level-headed people that are actually examining this from multiple facets.
Yeah, absolutely.
Different viewpoints.
Absolutely.
So Thank you.
While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Martin Leeper, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share, comment. That's where you can find all of the video channels of our guests at CuriousRealm.com/video, as well as all of their books, videos, and classes at CuriousRealm.com/store. While you're checking that out, if you are a Roku user, make sure to download the all-new Curious Realm Roku app. That's where you can catch all the shows. That's where you can catch awesome binaural beat and meditation music made by me. And don't forget, we are now officially carried by Ground Zero Media, Aftermath Media, Ground Zero Radio, as well as KGRA, KPNL. And thank you to Always Press Record Productions for helping us make our app. Thank you so much to the Falk Monster Festival for having us out. As always, this officially wraps our coverage of the 2024 Falk Monster Festival here in Falk, Arkansas. Thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. Remember, stay curious. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. And remember that without the conversation, we do not move forward as humanity. We just spin wheels. So take care of yourselves and each other, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, as well as KPNL Radio, APR TV, and the Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit groundzeromedia.org and aftermathmedia.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.